Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. On this podcast, I focus on understanding human behavior. I talk with people from various professions and walks of life about how understanding behavior has played a role in their work. You can learn more about this podcast, get episode summaries and links at readingpokertells.video. In today's episode, recorded March 24th, 2021, I talk with Nathan Feiler, who's written both a novel and a nonfiction book that both deal with the topic of psychosis and so-called schizophrenia. His novel was called The Shock of the Fall, and it was a Sunday Times bestseller. His nonfiction book is called The Heartland, Finding and Losing Schizophrenia, which has an alternate title, This Book Will Change the Way You Think About Mental Illness. And I recommend that book. That's the one I've read. It likely will change the way you think about mental illness, about madness, about so-called schizophrenia. Nathan also has a podcast coming out soon. It will be called Why Do I Feel? So keep an eye out for that. You may have noticed I used the term so-called schizophrenia. That's because that's how Nathan refers to schizophrenia in his book, The Heartland. And he makes good points for why so-called schizophrenia makes more sense as a descriptor than schizophrenia. One of the points he makes is that our categories, our names for these conditions, are very imprecise. So-called schizophrenia, for example, encompasses a wide range of symptoms and ways of being, of short and of long duration. And the lack of reliability in the diagnosis means it's fairly common for someone to be given a diagnosis of schizophrenia by one doctor and be given a label of bipolar by another doctor for the same behavior. On top of all that, the label of schizophrenia itself is scary and demoralizing. It makes people who receive that label fear the worst, to think of themselves as broken, when in actuality, many people go through various forms of psychotic episodes and do recover, and some people even go through quite long schizophrenic experiences lasting years and come out of it. So in Nathan's excellent book, he examines the uncertainty around these ways of being and makes the case we should be much more careful in our language and examine the ways in which how we talk about these conditions can affect people. Also an important part of his book is examining how these conditions can represent understandable ways of dealing with trauma and stress. The biological explanation of schizophrenia is, I think, how many people tend to understand these topics, or at least it's common to think that others who are, quote, mad, are very different from us in some way. Many people look at people suffering from such things and think, there's something very different about them. Thank God I'm not like that. But what if such people aren't that different from us? What if all of us were theoretically capable of experiencing these things given the right stress, the right rabbit holes of thinking to go down? His book includes several case histories of people suffering from different presentations of so-called schizophrenia, and he examines the stresses present in their environment. This is not to say that environment is the only factor, of course. Most experts in these areas believe there's some combination of biology and environment at work, and we'll talk about that a good amount in the interview. I'll also say that I'm interested in these topics for personal reasons because of the mental issues that I've struggled with. I'm going to describe some of that here as I see it related to the topic at hand. But if you want to go straight to the interview, just skip 5 minutes or so forward. So in high school, I started attending a private high school. This was in Southern Maryland. It was called St. Mary's Riken. All the friends I knew were going to public school, so I was surrounded by strangers. On top of that, there was a fancy academic vibe to this school. The first day, there was an orientation where we wore shirts and ties and talked to teachers and each other and such. At that event, as I tried to talk to all these intimidating strangers, I had a severe panic attack due to social anxiety. It was scary and all-encompassing. It felt mind-shattering. It was like nothing I'd experienced before. I went to the bathroom and stayed there for a while trying to recover. After it passed, it felt like I'd become an entirely new person. Looking back, it was like I'd suddenly achieved self-awareness, as if I'd just been a mindless child before that moment. And at the time, it wasn't any sort of pleasant self-awareness. I felt empty and ugly and dysfunctional. That was followed by bad general anxiety and depression for the next few years. I was withdrawn and silent my first 2 years of high school with almost no friends. I didn't tell anyone about my mental struggles, not my family, not my friends. In the second half of high school, I improved a bit. I made some friends, even had a couple girlfriends towards the end of high school. I was still quite anxious and depressed, but felt somewhat content, somewhat normal. Then I went to college to a pretty elite school called Washington and Lee in Virginia. And in that new stranger-filled environment, I started suffering from some of the same issues I'd had at the beginning of high school. I found myself feeling increasingly unwell, depressed, and anxious. On top of that, I was also smoking a good amount of weed with my roommates and on my own. and marijuana use is correlated with increased risk of anxiety and psychotic episodes. While these things are, of course, impossible to know, I do believe marijuana played a significant role in my own experiences. In my sophomore year, I had a very bad panic attack after smoking weed. Luckily, I was able to hide in the bathroom for a while. It's easy to imagine things would have escalated if I'd been around people when that happened. It's easy for me to imagine slipping into psychosis if it would have happened around people without a chance for escape. Similar to my high school experience, the phrase panic attack, from what I've read of most panic attacks, doesn't really do it justice. It felt like my mind was being fractured. It felt like I was losing my mind. If it helps give you a sense of how extreme it was, I'd take just about any physical pain over the pain of that experience. It was much worse than physical pain. Even after the extreme part of it had passed and I returned to being functional, I felt very broken. That episode kicked off a period of depersonalization, as it's called, a feeling of losing touch with reality, a feeling like I barely existed. Everything was unreal and scary. My grades had been suffering throughout that year. I went from getting good grades to doing quite badly. I'd always been good in math, and I wound up with a D in trigonometry. I was behaving strangely. I was hanging out in the empty basement of the college library a lot, and I was suddenly very interested with reading a bunch of obscure Zen Buddhism books, reading about various practices for reaching enlightenment, like contemplation of the horrible and ideas like that. I wondered if I had or was in the process of transcending mundane ways of seeing the world. Maybe I was reaching some transcendent state. Maybe that would explain things. Things reached a peak when one night, laying in bed, I had a sensation of myself being like a distant planet, a million miles from all other planets, other people, a feeling like there was no way to make connection with anyone ever again. That human connection itself was an illusion, that human connection would never be actually possible for me and maybe not for anyone else. This experience was, like the previous episodes I'd experienced, world-shattering, even more so. The idea of attending classes made me fearful and sweaty. I couldn't talk coherently when called upon in class. I was tongue-tied and filled with fear. I stopped talking to my roommates pretty much entirely. Everyone seemed like creatures from another dimension. In short, I had ceased being able to function in any socially acceptable way. Luckily, at that point, I had enough awareness to know that I was in very bad shape. I had enough awareness to call my parents to come pick me up from school, and my dad came and took me back home. After that, I continued to have extreme anxiety and weird sensations and unusual thoughts and fears. It felt like my sanity was balanced on the head of a pin, metaphorically speaking. One bad moment that stands out was when I was watching a movie and I suddenly had the perception of the people in the film as being just talking apes, as being strange animals, who'd somehow evolved to be able to emit sounds that the other strange animals could understand. And that realization, realizing how absurd and inexplicable our existence was, this human existence that up until then I'd taken for granted as just human life, simple and unquestioned. These thoughts filled me with terror. Human life suddenly seemed a sickening nightmare. Of course, these types of world-shattering anxieties are hard to communicate in words. When one is feeling stable and well, these thoughts might be just intellectually interesting lines of thought, but nothing that affects you viscerally. At other times, I imagined that maybe I'd been inhabited by an ancient alien spirit that had been traveling the universe, who'd taken over my body and kicked out my soul and supplanted it with this new blank one. Everything was strange and alien. Somehow, a few months later, I did go off to another college. I felt very bad, but I also felt that whatever fate awaited me at my parents' house was worse than what awaited me out in the world. I achieved some sort of normalcy despite my problems. I worked at the same time as going to college. I had relationships, albeit mostly dysfunctional ones. I worked after college. But I suffered from bad depression and anxiety for years after that. Probably up until I was 30 years old, if I could have pushed a button to end my life without any mess or drama, I would have done so, no questions asked. I did eventually reach a feeling of contentment in my life. I enjoy life currently. And I tell you that just to set you at ease, and maybe, if you can relate to these things, to say, it can get better, so keep hope alive. Now, my experiences didn't reach the level of so-called schizophrenia. I never would have been diagnosed as schizophrenic. And many people suffer from bad social anxiety like I had, from depersonalization, from existential anxieties of various sorts. But the reason I'm mentioning all this is that I do sometimes wonder if things had gone a bit differently for me. Might I have gone down a psychotic, schizophrenic path? It certainly seems possible to me based on my experiences and on reading some accounts of how schizophrenia starts. What if I didn't have a bit of a safe harbor to retreat to when things went bad? What if my worst panic attack experiences had happened when I was surrounded by people? how would that have escalated things? What if my coping skills, however they were formed, whether from my biology or my experiences, were just a bit worse? What if I didn't have various positive feelings and experiences from my past to give me some hope even in the depths of my despair? If I had become psychotic and been diagnosed as schizophrenic, would people point to the indicators in my earlier life and say, yes, his behavior in high school and college showed all the indicators of someone in a pre-schizophrenic period? I don't know the answers to these questions, and from what I understand of these topics, no one could answer them. But there are things I sometimes wonder, and it's why I'm interested in these areas, in exploring the factors behind how people experience these extremes of mental suffering. And it relates to what Nathan Filer talks about in his book, because maybe we all, or at least many of us, have the capacity to have these experiences if certain environmental factors are present. Maybe many of the people we perceive as mad are just like us. Maybe they're not, as we often think, vastly different people who are hard to understand. Maybe so-called mental illnesses are just various human ways of coping with extreme distress. And of course, maybe some genetic factors make some people more prone to such responses than others. Okay, here's the interview with Nathan Filer about his book, The Heartland, Finding and Losing Schizophrenia. All right, thanks so much for coming on, Nathan.
Thank you so much for having me, Zach.
You have an interesting body of work because your work includes an award-winning novel about someone struggling with so-called schizophrenia, and you've also written a respected nonfiction work about mental illness. And that seems like a pretty rare combination. So I'm curious if you see your goals with both works as accomplishing some of the same things in terms of heightening awareness and empathy for mental struggles.
Yeah, I mean, it's often easier as an author to declare what our goals were after the fact. In the moment, I think I'm just trying to write a book that will be readable and that people will enjoy and engage with. But certainly those two books that I have written, the work of fiction, The Shock of the Fool, and the subsequent non-fiction work, The Heartland, I think they're very much in conversation with each other, and of course they share that common theme of trying to understand people going through a really difficult time, I guess. So fiction felt like the right way to explore some of those questions initially, and then nonfiction did.
Mm-hmm. So maybe a good place to start also is for me to try to summarize what I see as some of your beliefs about psychosis and so-called schizophrenia. And maybe I'll state that, and then you can correct me where you see I'm stating it wrong.
Well, to be honest, Zach, I'm really not sure what my stance is. So I'd love for you to tell me, and then I'll probably just agree. I'll agree. If you make me sound reasonable and erudite, I'm going to agree and
sure,
say that's
sure.
my stance.
Well, I think I like about you, before I get to that, I like that you come from a very uncertain point of view. And I think a lot of these conversations can sound very certain and confident, but I think, you know, the power of your work is talking about the lack of certainty, the doubt we should have about many of these areas. So I'll try to summarize this and see what you think. So I think you believe that while there may be various genetic or biological factors that make people more likely to enter states of psychosis or so-called schizophrenia, that many of these experiences are understandable ways that a human mind can respond to various kinds of trauma or stress. And while most people who study these areas believe that there is some combination of nature and nurture at work, you believe that we as a society and those in the psychiatry sector tend to focus too much on the biological factors instead of the environmental and human factors. And we act too certain about our very fallible human-made categories and believe that these things have negative effects in terms of our ability to help people. Is that a pretty good summary of your thoughts on that area?
I'd say it is. Yeah, I think that's a wrap. I think we've got a podcast.
Okay. Nice talking to you, Mike.
I think that is broadly true and fair. I think you know, ideas and philosophies go in and out of fashion in psychiatry. I mean, I suppose they do in all aspects of medicine to a degree, but it feels especially so in psychiatry, where those current sort of decisions or orthodoxies aren't necessarily led by the science. They can be influenced, I think, by politics a lot as well, actually. And so I think it's fair what you say there in sort of summarizing my position as being that we are a little bit too or modern psychiatry is a little bit too focused on the what we might call the biomedical model, and has not paid enough attention in recent years to you know the sort of psychological, environmental, but that is always in shift. It's always changing. The pendulum swings all the time, and we can talk a little bit about why that is and why we are where we are right now. But it's arguably a little bit too biomedical, and I think that is probably more so in the States where you are than where I am in the UK actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one thing that's been a bit unclear to me in this area is how much pushback there is against these ideas of talking about the environmental factors and you know stress as causes, because obviously there are many experts who are on the same page as you, and you quote some of them in your book, but it's not clear to me how much pushback there is. For example, are there people in the psychiatry world who would read your book and say you're way off base in focusing on these aspects? Are there people who say schizophrenia is all or mostly a physical malady, and it's wrong to talk about these environmental factors?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was the dominant view for probably the best part of a century that schizophrenia was a deteriorating brain disease. I think that's been pretty fundamentally undermined now by the evidence, actually. But of course, there are people who would occupy that position and consider these things to be, you know, in entirely biological, and certainly there are people at the other end on the sort of a sort of radical critical psychiatry end who perhaps discount the role of our biology or our genetics too much, you know, completely. I think they are pretty extreme positions, and it may just be something of a sort of symptom of our times, isn't it, that these people who hold these more extreme positions often have quite loud voices, and maybe you know we sort of see them on social media or what have you. So I think a lot of that debate from those two extreme ends is it's loud, but probably there aren't loads of people occupying those positions. I think most people do accept and appreciate that when we're talking about mental illness, and we can get into what that means in a minute, because even that's controversial. Mm-hmm. But when we're talking about this thing generally understood to be mental illness, we're talking about a kind of distress that probably has its causes both in the sort of biological and the social realms. Mm-hmm. But we need to be, I think, like, we need to be careful straight away, really. And when talking about mental health, I think it's like really important that we take a moment to always define some of our terms and make sure that we are talking about the same things. I mean, and I think that's, you know, especially so when talking about something as contentious and potentially sort of loaded and upsetting for people. Mm-hmm. As this idea of causes. You know, you mentioned in your when talking about my position, I try and hold on to a position of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Rather than sort of, you know, dogmatic declaring something as fact. And that's really important with causes, because the science is not at the point where any professional of any stripes can say to an individual what caused them to develop a mental illness or become distressed in those kind of ways. All we can do really is look at trends. You know, we can look at big trends from big cohorts of people, and from that we see not causes but significant correlation, and it's from those correlations that we can be, I think, pretty certain that there's a major environmental component to this. To sort of add to complicate the picture a bit more, this is partly an issue of sort of professional guilds and, mm-hmm. you know, what area of healthcare you work in and that you've trained in. So I think there has been in recent years a bit of a power struggle, a little bit of a tussle, I think, actually, between psychiatry, this sort of medical discipline of psychiatry, and psychology, which I think to many people, you know, would maybe assume they're one and the same thing, but they are sort of subtly different disciplines, actually, and tend to acknowledge some of the points made by the other discipline, but emphasize their own position.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's great about your book is the focus on the uncertainty, the focus on the careful language, because the language really matters, and you talk about that in your book, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but I'll segue into a little bit of the controversial area. So it's been shown that childhood stresses of various sorts, whether that's sexual assault or the death of a family member or being a refugee or an immigrant, those kinds of stresses increase the chances of having psychotic or schizophrenic experiences. And that aspect seems understood and respected, even for, you know, experts in this area who believe it's mostly genetic or biological. But then it follows that...
And it intuitively makes sense, doesn't it? I think, you know, I mean, for it to be controversial, but I think most people would say, well, sure, having horrendous things go on in your life is going to impact on your mental health. It just is sort of, I think that intuitively makes sense, doesn't it?
I think the controversial part of it comes to be, you know, if we acknowledge that that is true, then it follows that there are other childhood factors that can cause stress, like the neglect of parents, the mistreatment of children in ways that don't, you know, rise to the level of abuse, just ways of interacting with children. And I think that's where the controversial areas seem to arise, because parents understandably don't want to be told their behavior may play a role in such things, or even, you know, even if there's no judgment involved, they don't want to, you know, they don't want to feel that perception of judgment. And you talk about that in your book, about the pushback, you know, of talking about those kinds of ideas and how the history of that played out, because there's, you know, definitely examples where that kind of idea was done in a very irresponsible manner, like talking about the idea of the schizophrenic mother, you know, idea. And can you talk a little bit about that history of that kind of pushback?
Sure. Yeah. Cause it is really important. And it probably partly explains, possibly more than partly, it significantly explains why we are where we are at the moment with our thinking. So as I say, I mean, ideas go in and out of fashion in psychiatry as they do in other medical disciplines, but for a long time, psychiatry was really all about that sort of psychological way of thinking. It was very enamored of the kind of Freudian way of thinking. If we look back to the sort of middle of the last century, so between the end of the Second World War and the 1970s, psychiatry was very much about psychotherapy and very much about the role of the family in your mental health. And it was during that period that it invented, as you say, this very sort of bafflingly Freudian and transparently misogynistic notion of the schizophrenogenic mother. So you know, and really, you know, mothers could do no right here. You know, they either drove their children to madness by caring for them too much, or not caring for them enough, or caring for them in the wrong kind of ways. And you know, understandably, families didn't like that. Of course they didn't. And they formed, and this is especially part of the history in America, you know, of American psychiatry, because it was really there that these sort of powerful lobbying groups formed to push back against that. And there were a few other factors then that came together, creating a bit of a perfect storm, really. So there were these families going, no, don't really like being blamed for this, actually. We're doing our best. And then there were these drug companies, you know, there were these new psychiatric drugs coming on the market from the 1950s, sort of antipsychotic drugs and so on. And of course, these drug companies had a vested interest in this other narrative around, no, this is a biochemical imbalance, and the best way to deal with it is using other chemicals. So they started to fund these lobbying and campaign groups. And then there was a third factor, and I don't know whether it possibly goes into a bit too much detail for your podcast, but you'd be the judge of that, of course. But psychiatry also in the 1970s was in a bit of an embarrassed position. A few studies had come out that were demonstrating that it really wasn't very good at diagnostics. There was very poor reliability. Two psychiatrists who'd seen the same patient just sometimes mere moments apart would arrive at different diagnoses. There was the famous or infamous, depending on your position, Rosenhan experiment. You may be familiar with that. So this was this researcher who got himself deliberately incarcerated in mental health wards, along with his fellow researchers, claiming to have some psychotic symptoms. But the moment they were accepted on the ward, they no longer said they had any of those symptoms. They acted completely sane, for want of a better word.
They couldn't get out.
And yet they were all kept in hospital for a really long time.
For a while, and
couldn't get out. Yeah, so this idea of being sort of sane in the insane place. And you know, it was probably around this time as well, there was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest came out. So this kind of, you know, so there was a lot of stuff going on. And psychiatry was in a really sort of embarrassed position. And the way it tried to deal with this sort of poor reliability problem, poor diagnosis problem, was to create sort of much, much clearer diagnostic rules. You know, it sort of categorized mental distress in ways that had never really been done before, or certainly not to the same extent, and it led to this a document, a very famous document in the history of psychiatry, called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, Volume 3. There'd been a couple of other versions before, but one that came out in I think sort of 1980 was the one that really changed everything and started to say, no, these mental disorders can be categorized. And we will arrive at a diagnosis only when patients show these exact symptoms for this exact amount of time, and started to make it look and feel a lot more scientific. So all of these things came together, you know, the DSM, the categorization, the family groups, the drug companies, and it came together, and it pushed that pendulum so far in the other direction, to the point that we really stopped talking at all about this. You know, there was a shameful sort of hangover perhaps of that schizophrenogenic mother as well, so that had been completely discredited, and so we just stopped talking about environmental causes at all, and that's the position now that we're sort of trying to come back to from around the 1980s.
And as you point out in your book too, another factor in this too is just the fact that trying to examine the causes, the environmental causes, would require so much effort, and it's much easier to think about the, you know, treating it purely biologically, just from a resources and finance, you know, because even, you know, theoretically, if you believe that someone suffering from so-called schizophrenia could benefit from long-term, you know, talk therapy and such, that's a huge expenditure of resources compared to, you know, giving medicine.
Yeah, that's an interesting position. I mean, I think many listeners would still find it like fairly extraordinary that questions about your childhood are so rarely asked for the most unwell people in right. hospitals. So we know, you know, I mean, I can give you some just gut-wrenching statistics, really, from the UK. We know that one of our sort of charities, institutions over here that looks at cruelty to children, the NSPCC, we know that about 1 in 20 children are suffer abuse in childhood. I mean, that alone is just horrendous to think about, mm-hmm. isn't it? That's more than one child in every classroom. Mm-hmm. We know that between half and three quarters of psychiatric inpatients have suffered childhood abuse, and yet the majority of psychiatric inpatients are never asked about that. And mm-hmm. the group that are least likely to be asked are people with those kind of, you know, more sort of devastating psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia. And that might in part be, you know, as I say, part of that sort of just that sort of horrible, shameful hangover from the schizophrenogenic mother, mm-hmm. that psychiatrists just feel like that's some territory that they don't want to go there.
Right. Yeah, and it's understandable even without that history. I mean, it's understandable in the sense that there is naturally pushback against, it makes sense that parents don't want to examine those aspects sometimes, because it's tough feeling like there's aspects of the, you know, environment you've created for a child playing a role in this stuff. So it does make sense even just at that level that there are these pushbacks. And I want to get your take on this, because it seems to me, you know, a big part of trying to make progress in this area is the power of language, because in order to talk about these things and to make progress on these factors, you would have to talk about these things in a way that doesn't communicate responsibility, blame. So there has to be a way of talking about it in terms of like, look, there are environmental factors, and if these played a role, if these theoretically played a role in your, you know, your child's, of how they developed it, it doesn't mean it's your fault, because at the end of the day, we're very complex creatures, and being human is stressful, and we all have our ways of coping with the world, and we all just face so many challenges. So, and talking about it in these more empathetic ways.
Yeah, no, I hear you, and I think you're exactly right. We need to be able to have those as non-judgmental conversations, don't we?
And that's tough.
That's difficult, because people in those positions, you know, if you've got children and your children are, you know, teenage children or whatever, and someone you love is becoming really, really poorly, and you know, you're going to be in a sort of just a heightened, difficult state anyway, aren't you? So, I mean, it might not, you know, that might not be the time to have those conversations. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, what we've got to look at is, how do we move forward with this? How do we help? How do we live with this? But you're right that it doesn't need to be, or the evidence seems to suggest that it doesn't need to necessarily be sort of the kind of extreme childhood trauma abuse that we might all intuitively feel. Of course, that could lead to poor mental health. It can be really surprising things. So apparently there's a couple of studies that have shown that even something as seemingly innocuous as moving school a couple mm-hmm. of times in adolescence, that can sort of double your chances of having psychosis or a schizophrenia. We need to be careful that when we say, because you know, you say double your chances, and that sounds absolutely huge, but of course all that really does is potentially increase it from 1% to 2% chance. So it's still you're still not saying that if you move school, you're definitely going to get unwell. But
it's difficult to talk about, because they can feel judgmental, even if the intent is not judgmental. And, you know, and one thing that stands out to me is talking about it seems like there's power to talking about the chance element of these things, because, you know, theoretically somebody who develops so-called schizophrenia in like a normal seeming household, maybe somebody in that, a different person in that exact same situation wouldn't develop schizophrenia. It means that there's chance elements here, and there's ways of being, there's ways of that the environment can affect us, there's ways that our genetics can affect us that lead to these things. And it doesn't mean anyone's to blame necessarily, but talking about it in that way might allow us to examine the factors and talk about it without it being perceived as judgmental, basically. And it's all about language, really.
You're exactly right. And on that point of, you know, two people in the same household might go in two very different directions, even though, you know, ostensibly have the same upbringing. I mean, I suppose there's something to wrestle with there as well. But yeah, it is worth pointing out that though we know that's a very strong correlation with adverse childhood events, it's still the case that the majority of the people who experience difficult childhood do not go on to have to become mentally unwell, or if they do, to go on to have the same sort of symptoms and arrive at the same diagnosis. And this is, I think, where our you know, genetics and so on really comes into it. You know, so what mm-hmm. sends someone in one direction or another, I think that will be influenced by the sort of risk factors or protective factors of our genes.
Right. I think for a lot of these things, it's recognizing the role of basically chaotic, you know, all these chaotic complex factors interacting. You know, for example, my own, you know, mental struggles and when I dropped out of college, you know, involved me smoking a lot of weed, and that's been shown to, you know, be associated with panic and anxiety and depersonalization and then the so-called schizophrenia and psychosis stuff too. There's a link there, but my point is just that, you know, maybe I wouldn't have had those problems, wouldn't have gone down that path if a few things hadn't aligned, if I hadn't smoked weed, for example, or whatever. But basically just acknowledging that there can be many factors, and, you know, just because some things happen doesn't mean they necessarily had to happen that way, but it still means we can examine the factors, you know, and how they played a role.
Sure. Yeah. And we can't, I think, for things as you know, complex as the human mind, and certainly, you know, these sort of psychiatric labels like schizophrenia, which describes, you know, so many sort of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, such a range of symptoms. I don't think we can, we just cannot talk about sort of single causes. You can't with your genes either, you know, as I use that term, you know, we're talking about risk factors or protective factors, not a clear causal link. I think that the cannabis one is really interesting because there certainly is strong correlation there between certain sorts of cannabis and psychosis, so you know, detachment from reality. And there have been some pretty compelling studies around that. One study, a robust study, arriving at the conclusion that the number of sort of first presentation psychosis in South London could be reduced by about 25% if this particular type of cannabis, we call it skunk, I don't know whether you call it skunk there, but this sort of high concentration THC cannabis were removed, that would reduce first presentation psychosis by really quite a lot. But there's some interesting other data that came out of that, which is it seems that there's sort of other more natural strains of cannabis, so these kinds that have not been sort of genetically modified to increase this THC ingredient, these more natural strains which have more of something called CBD, cannabidiol, which very fashionable now in health food shops and stuff, isn't it? Cannabidiol. It seems that that has a sort of antipsychotic,
right? Has a mediating influence on the THC or something. Yeah,
it seems to be to the point that that's leading to some research now as to whether CBD could have antipsychotic properties in its own right. So the picture is never simple.
The weed aspect too, it's I think to the things you talk about in your book and the things I've thought about in my life with my experiences, it's our struggles can have a underlying logical cause, and it's possible for these various forms of stress, whether that's like weed aided semi-psychotic experiences or whether that's trauma of other sorts, these things can lead us to experiences that make a certain sense. Like, for example, when I was having my extreme anxiety and dropped out of college and was smoking a lot of weed, the marijuana led me to some dark mental pathways. But in hindsight, those pathways made a lot of sense because I felt very isolated, and a lot of my struggles had a narrative. They could be put in a narrative framework of, I felt very isolated, and at an existential level, isolation is a very stressful thing. And that's some of the stuff you talk about in your book too, trying to put these, because it can seem from the outside like, oh, that's a biological thing. That's something that someone very different from me is experiencing. But I think at the end of the day, we all have the capacity to go down these mental pathways given the right environment, given the right experience, and depending on our upbringing and such too. But yeah, I think there's a lot to examining the logical reasons behind the reason people are going down these dark pathways.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think, there's a story in there, isn't there? People are living, we live our life and we're living a story. And I think that within some of those maybe unusual thoughts that we have when we're becoming, what some people would call mentally ill, contained within that, within a delusion, for example, inherent to that is a narrative, is a story. The brain's sort of telling itself a story in order to try and make sense of uncertainty, isn't it? So, and I think this is one of the reasons why I'm drawn to that way of thinking about mental health rather than that more sort of binary, well, this is just madness, so we just need to get rid of the madness, and just see delusions as something that are either sort of present or absent, and we should get rid of them. I'm much more interested in the content, and I don't know whether that's partly as well, I'm a storyteller, this is the area that I work in, so of course I am, but I think we all should be, and certainly I think that mental health professionals should be interested in people's psychotic, quote unquote, psychotic thoughts as well as unpsychotic ones, because they're all part of that person's story, aren't they?
Yeah, and getting to that narrative aspect, I mean, that's that overlap between your fiction and nonfiction endeavors. And I think, I've often thought there's so much to this, our self-narratives, our narratives of the world that are operating under the surface of our consciousness. So-called healthy ways of navigating the world represent the culmination of all these sorts of unexamined, unknown narratives about our own lives, about the world. As a pretty functional person, myself at this moment in time anyway, I have various narratives about myself, like I'm capable of future enjoyment of life, I am a functional entity, or other people are mostly similar to myself and they can be understood by me, or even other people are just as real as me. And all of these unspoken aspects of our self-narrative, of our worldview, you know, we take those for granted mostly because they operate, they're such things that were built by our childhood experiences and that we don't really question or ever think about or don't have to confront consciously. But I think what happens with people with mental struggles is that those things are not a given. In fact, they can malfunction in various ways. And, you know, there's probably common experiences about life that lead people's self-narratives or world narratives to malfunction in pretty, you know, common ways and in various categories of ways. But I'm curious what you think about those ideas. I haven't seen much in that area. And I'm kind of curious if you have seen resources that talk about those kind of unspoken narratives.
Well, I was just fascinated to hear you say all of that, really. I just think you articulated it. I think you articulated it so well. It makes me want to come back and listen to this podcast just to hear you say that again. So, yeah, I mean, in some ways, I suppose, you know, your understanding of these things or your guesses is as good as mine. But it's an extremely sort of complex area, isn't it? But in terms of like what we hold as certain and what we don't question and how that makes us mentally robust. I think, you know, we can turn our attention again to some of those children who perhaps had considerably less certainty in childhood, you know, when you're not even sure that the people who are there to protect you are going to look after mm-hmm. you. You know, of course, that's going to introduce a lot more sort of noise into the system, isn't it, of what we can actually rely on and what we're not so sure about. So, but yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I've got much more to say than that, Zach. I think you said it very well yourself.
Yeah, those are the things that really interest me. I mean, because I've spent a good amount of time thinking about my own experiences and reading a lot on this subject, and I kind of think it's interesting just thinking about the unexamined assumptions that we make about the world as functioning mentally healthy people. You know, these unexamined under the hood assumptions. You know, for example, you know, there's different ways you can have stress in childhood. Like if you're neglected, if no one pays attention to you, then that impacts your ability to be an independent entity. You've kind of you're lacking in your ability to define yourself as a separate person. So that leads to a slew of problems in itself too. But yeah, definitely a whole interesting subject. That's
what we still need to be careful to do, of course, is even if something like that, you know, if the narrative of that feels very neat, we need to be careful not to you know, arrive then at that kind of assumption. Mm-hmm. So therefore, that explains everything because then we're falling into the same
right,
trap
exactly.
that others have done.
Exactly. You can examine these factors while still saying like, well, we don't know everything, and there's obviously also big genetic and biological components to this too. I think what, you know, the strength of examining the things that you examine in your book is not to say that they're the only reason. It's to say, if we're going to solve this, if we're going to help solve it, then maybe we need to think about, you know, the way that the environment or someone's way of being is putting stress on someone, even if it's not the only cause or far from the only cause. Yeah.
Also, just to pick up a bit more on your point there, those kind of real sort of questioning those sort of really big existential ideas, which seems like, you know, it fed into to some of your experience. I certainly can speak for whether, you know, you see more of that kind of thinking in people who become, you know, psychotically unwell. I don't know, but certainly from my experience of working in mental health and being, you know, working in that area, something that anecdotally I think I've seen is that lots of people who become very unwell in that kind of way are very sensitive people. And I mean by that, like sensitive to the world around them, sensitive to interpersonal relationships. They feel things very deeply. They pick up on sort of small signals from people. But you know, it's important then to stress that, of course, being a sensitive person, that can be a really good thing, can't it? You know, you would expect, wouldn't you, that somebody, you would hope that a doctor or a nurse working in mental health would be a sensitive person. So what leads you then into becoming an unwell person? Well, that's going to be circumstance, isn't it?
Yeah, then there's some, you know, some theories, biological theories of, you know, so-called schizophrenia that talk about like sensory gating malfunctions, you know, like people who are prone to that show more activation when presented with various sensory input. I don't know how much what the science is on that these days, but I know that that was something that they looked into. When
sure. And of course, for every study that tells you one thing, there's another study that that tells you something else. And it is, I mean, it is a bit of a problem as well, I think, with this sort of, you know, with the neuroscience. I mean, I think the genetics is sort of like, that's in a pretty robust position, really. You know, these genetic studies often have like huge cohorts of people, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. You compare that to neuroscience, where they might have sort of 8 students that, you know, sort of convenient sample from the university that they put in a fMRI machine and then wonder why there's poor sort of replicability in these studies. I think, you know, partly there's just problems there with the study design. And I think that, you know, there's something, you know, maybe very attractive to people that, you know, the answers are there to be found by the neuroscientists. They're really clever and they understand the brain, and so we don't need to worry about it because they're on top of it. But you know what we're coming to accept now, and you know, the science is coming to accept is, no, they're really not all over it. there's a lot of questions and a lot of uncertainty still.
Right, exactly, yeah. I wanted to take a moment to, you know, plug a book that I found was very wise and meaningful in these areas. It's so besides Nathan's book, which, by the way, what's your name of your book? I should mention that here.
Yeah. So I've got a couple out, of course. So the hardback of it was the Heartland. The paperback is This Book Will Change Your Mind About Mental Health. My novel is The Shock of the Fool. But I don't know, Zach, how available any of these books are in the States. I did an event for a charity in the States just the other week, and that issue came up then. But maybe some of your listeners would like to listen to my podcast. So maybe you could point them in the direction of that.
Your books are definitely on Amazon. Your novel had had another name though, didn't it?
Yeah, it's had a couple of, all my books get renamed.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have a lot of names for your books. I'm confused.
Yeah, it's like I've got about 4 books. And actually, you know, the Shock of the Fool was published, that was published in about 30 countries, and they each came up with a different name. So it looks like I've done loads.
It's a good cover, good disguise. Yeah, it looks impressive.
The podcast when it is, the podcast when it goes out, hopefully in the summer, will be called Why Do I Feel? That's a podcast looking at human emotions and stories.
Looking forward to that. But and getting back to the, I was going to mention Irvin Yalom's book, which is Existential Psychotherapy, which is just a fantastic book. And it talks about existential psychology ideas. He didn't come up with it, but the idea behind that, you know, field of thinking is that there's these basic facts about our existence as, you know, thinking beings that are big contributors to our mental anxieties and stresses. You know, for example, the fact that we have to deal with, you know, fear of death is one big stress. The fact that we all at some level deal with fears of isolation because we're both separate from other people, alone in our minds, and yet we want to commune with others to make contact. And so there's that tension between isolation and merging with others. But anyway, just a great book.
Well, do you remember, yeah, Zach, that when we first met on the Twitter, you recommended that book to me and I bought it.
Oh.
I hung on your every word and I bought that book and it arrived, and then I saw the size of it and I could barely yeah, pick it up. I was like, do you know, yeah, I'm gonna read that one later.
My wife took a year to read it, yeah, but she loved it. I'll say also, my wife read it and she's like, she agreed with me that it was like getting, you know, months or years of therapy. Like, I don't want to overstate it, but I think the ideas are that powerful. And I also think I'm kind of shocked that there's not a more, I've looked around and I can't find a more accessible way to, I mean, I think for anybody, you know, I thought about it myself, trying to put these ideas in a more accessible format, because I just think the ideas are so powerful. And I've even reached out to Dr. Yalom, and he was, unfortunately, when I talked to him about having him on the podcast, his wife had just passed away. So it was bad timing. But I just think these ideas are so powerful. And I think you would really enjoy them because they deal with things that you can relate to, that you talk about in your book, that the fact that these are the struggles that people are going through are very understandable in a way, or at least they can be put in understandable narratives, not to say that it explains every element of them. But I think, you know, even for my own mental struggles, I can very much relate to the fact that when I was a kid or from the outside, my struggles might have looked like, oh, you're going crazy, these ideas don't make any sense. But thinking about it more as I have over the years, they actually do make a lot of sense. They make sense in the sense that they were about fears of isolation. They were about fears of meaningless. They were about fears of me not being able to be a functioning person in the world, you know, and these are all understandable aspects of being human. I was just confronted with them head on, you know, whether that was through factors in my upbringing, whether that was me smoking a lot of weed, whatever it was, I had to face these fears in some way, you know, these various stresses. And I think, you know, what happens to a lot of people is that they get in those situations and it seems like they're going crazy because we don't talk about these problems as a society when I think we should be, you know, these are things that everybody should be talking about. Like the fact that it's very weird to be a human and to deal with this existence. There's a lot of stressful things about this existence and that we tend to take for granted and not talk about. But yeah, I just think you'd love the book, basically.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And it raises some interesting questions as well, doesn't it, about maybe what we mean by recovery. And again, then you can go into different models because you can think of this sort of medical model of recovery as this sort of complete remission of what you might call clinical symptoms. But for some people, like, of course, that doesn't wash. When you've had, such an extraordinary sort of change in your mental state and before been forced to confront some of these ideas and things about yourself, well, then recovery might not be a return to where you were before. It might be, as you're describing, a kind of a sort of attribution of meaning to those things and understanding what that meant and growing from that.
It's tough to talk about these things too, because, you know, sort of like we were talking about parents feeling judged. I mean, someone going through, you know, so-called schizophrenia psychosis can feel judged by even bringing up the idea that these things might be understood, you know, that there's that kind of pushback too. Like, for example, you know, I have a friend that I talked to recently and she had had a psychotic break in the middle of her life. And we talked about, you know, the things that led up to that. And you know, it can be perceived as, you know, judgmental and that can be demeaning in itself to say like, oh, examine why this happened to you. And so there is that pushback too. So it gets back to the way we talk about these things, because we have to find a way to talk about them in ways that are not judgmental. Because I, you know, the fact that I got over whatever thing, not to compare my stuff to, you know, other people's stuff, because mine was not that extreme. Everyone's different. But the fact that I maybe had better results than other people who went through similar things is not a reflection on my strength. It's my abilities. It's just a reflection of chaotic things that were happening, and that, you know, maybe my genetics were slightly different, or maybe I had some, you know, slightly better environmental stuff like that helped me through. It's not about judgment or assigning responsibility. So I think it comes back to the careful language, you know, of talking about like these things often are not in our control, you know, but it's tough to talk about. Yeah.
Oh, I agree. My silence is a poignant agreement.
Sorry, yeah, I get nervous on the podcast. I think I lose people.
No, well, you didn't lose me at all. No, I completely concur.
I do have one thing I was just kind of curious about was writing your novel and then writing your nonfiction work. Did anyone kind of scoff at you because you were first a novelist? I can imagine that happening, but I'm kind of curious if people were like, oh, he's a novelist, he's looking for clean narratives or something like that.
If people have made that criticism, and of course they may have done, they've not made it directly to me. So I've been sort of happy with the response. And I think that most readers, including readers in the various professions, have seen that I really am attempting here to just ask the questions, to listen to people's stories, mm-hmm. to not sort of force my own opinion. Mm-hmm. Partly because I don't have a very strong opinion about these things. You know, I did sort of enter the writing of that book very much as a student, really, rather than trying to be a teacher. But possibly where I've received a little bit more criticism, or where people sort of question my position, was on the novel, actually. And I think that's because, you know, I worked in mental health. I was a mental health nurse, but I was writing that novel from the position of a mental health service user, a patient, somebody who was you know, really very unwell in a way that I had not been. And I think that does raise interesting and relevant questions, more so today probably than when I published it, around sort of appropriation and who has the right to write what. I mean, my personal position with that was, in that novel, I wasn't trying to tell everybody's story. I was telling one fictional character's story. It drew a lot, actually, from my own childhood as well. But of course, I had to do a lot of imagining with that, and I think that's what novelists should do. I think that's part of, you know, an exercise in empathy, to, you know, imagine ourselves into someone else's experience and to spend time with that as we ask our readers to do by reading the book. But of course, we do that as an author as well. And I think I've sort of made that point, really, that I think mental health care and writing a novel and reading a novel all share that one thing in common, that to do them well, they require a good deal of empathy. But certainly, I think for some readers, and maybe, you know, readers who'd maybe had a very challenging time with psychiatry, you know, perhaps they've been very unhappy with their experiences of psychiatric treatment and so on. I think for some of those people, the fact that I was a mental health nurse is always going to be problematic. And, you know, I respect that. Of course I do.
Yeah, I sometimes think the benefit of art is that it's educating us in empathy. You know, if you had to give a practical, you know, quality to a lot of art, it is allowing us to see the world through other eyes, you know, in various ways. Even art that doesn't seem like it's giving you a lot of intellectual, actual philosophy or intellectual point of view, it still often is giving you a different perspective on the world, which is related to empathy.
Absolutely. I think that's, you know, that's absolutely central to fiction.
That's the connection there with both of your works there. Yeah, it's increasing empathy.
And with the second book, which is very much sort of story led, you know, so I tell the stories of five individuals who lived with or very close to a diagnosis of schizophrenia. You know, that book is entirely led by those stories. So they're not case studies. They make up more than 50% of the book, which is quite unusual in mental health sort of nonfiction, which would often be quite, I think, sort of ideas led. And then case studies would be included to sort of illustrate those ideas. But it did feel important to me. Well, that just wasn't the route that I took. I listened to the stories, told those stories as best I could, which comes with a huge amount of responsibility. You know, I mean, writing fiction is difficult for any number of reasons, but writing this kind of nonfiction was extremely, you know, came with a great burden of responsibility. I was being trusted with these people's stories, you know, to hear them and to share them. But that was the process for me, to be with those stories and then see where those stories led in terms of exploring the ideas that came up from them.
Yeah, and it's such a fraught area, you know, as you discuss in your book. I mean, it's a great book. I thought it was fantastic, and it's also it's great to hear that you didn't get much pushback for the non-fiction book, which says to me, you know, which is what one of my things I was curious about, was like, how much pushback is there to these ideas? And the fact that I, you know, looking for reviews of your book, I couldn't find much in the way of criticism of it. And the fact that you have multiple experts,
it's because I sat so firmly on the fence.
Sure, sure. Yeah. But even just,
you know, if I'd gone down one, you know, one position or the other, I'm sure I would have got a lot more.
But even just the fact that, you know, talking about the environmental factors as potential causes, you know, even just that discussion, because I've been uncertain like how that is perceived. And I think reading the experts quoted in your book and reading other resources and reading reviews of your book, you know, I've gotten a better understanding that, you know, most experts on the subject, whether psychiatry or psychology, are, you know, are in the middle somewhere, where it's like, obviously there's genetic biological factors, and also obviously there are environmental factors, which is, you know, may seem kind of obvious to people in that area, but I think is, you know, not that obvious to people, you know, who might just read a handful of things. Yeah. Yeah, so this has been great. Thanks so much for coming on. It's been a real honor, and I wish you the luck with everything else you're working on, including the podcast.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
This has been an interview with Nathan Feiler about so-called schizophrenia and about his book, The Heartland, Finding and Losing Schizophrenia.
You can follow Nathan on Twitter at Nathan Filer, F-I-L-E-R. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. You can follow me on Twitter at apokerplayer. You can learn more about this podcast at readingpokertells.video. If you enjoy this podcast, please know that I make no money from it. In fact, it's a pretty big expenditure of time and energy for me. So if you want to do me a big favor, please share word of it on social media and give it a rating on iTunes. This is a labor of love for me. Everybody's got a podcast these days, as you probably know. And it's pretty hard to gain listeners when you're competing with the big podcasts that have so much advertising money behind them. This is not to complain. I love talking to all these interesting people and getting to ask questions that are otherwise hard for me to find answers for. Okay, thanks for listening.
Music by Small Skies.